Well, good morning. It's good to be with all of you here. It's a wonderful Lord's Day. I appreciate Kevin and Sarah putting me up. Probably thank you for putting up with me as well for the week. But I'm very thankful to be here. And last time I hear, I think it was on a more solemn note, the Kent Yeaters passing. We'll be here to worship and to praise God and to learn some more about His Word and what He wants from us as His children. For some of you who don't know me, I've been in the Marine Corps for about 11 years and traveled different areas of this state and outside of the state several times in service of this country. But more importantly, I've found in those situations that there are lessons to be learned, life lessons to be learned from God's Word that I thought would be helpful for us to kind of look at and to apply. This morning, I want us to look at a few different kind of pictures the Bible has of this warfare that we face. And we'll start in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 and verse 12. And by the way, this is a class, so it is I encourage discussion, and we don't want to just hear me talking up here. I already know what I know, so I like to hear sometimes what other people know as well. It's probably a lot better than what I know anyways. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 through verse 12. And the topic of this beginning of this study this morning is just this idea of choosing sides. There seems to be this picture of this warfare that we're in as Christians. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 3 depicts us as soldiers fighting this good fight. And in Ephesians chapter 6, I want you just to notice in verse 10 through verse 12, "Finally, be strengthened by the Lord and by His vast strength. Put on the full armor of God so that you can stand against the tactics of the devil. For our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the world powers of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavens." First and foremost, what do you notice here about the battle? And I ask this question, whose battle is this in this text? It says ours. Our battle we face. One of the challenges for me, and growing up, I always had this picture in my mind of this light versus darkness, this Jesus versus Satan. And I'm just kind of a bystander standing on the sidelines watching this great battle occur. And there certainly is that picture that Satan is defeated by Christ. It is not anything of my particular will that I have the specific strength to take on Satan. Even Michael the archangel would have nothing to say against the devil in that situation. But whose battle is this in Ephesians? It is our battle. I'd like to look at a few other kind of texts with this in mind. Turn over to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. And what I'm doing here is just trying to have us look at some of these texts and kind of see a little bit more that this is not just a battle that we stand and watch. This is not just a fight that we kind of stand on the sidelines and go, "That was pretty interesting." This is something that each and every one of us faces in this warfare. Many of us are familiar with Genesis chapter 3, verse 15 as the first prophecy made about Christ. But notice, "I will put hostility," this is God talking to Satan, "I will put hostility between you," Satan, "and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He will strike your head and you will strike his heel." Now, if you're familiar with Galatians chapter 3 and verse 14, when he refers back to this prophecy, he talks about it as one. This seed is one who is Christ. And I'm not detracting from that. It is Jesus who is ultimately the seed. But I'd like to ask you guys a question when you look at this passage. If Jesus is the only thing being talked about here as the seed, who is the seed of Satan? Who is the seed of Satan in this context? those who follow Satan. And I'll make this point even clearer. Look over at John chapter 8 in verse 39. My point from Genesis 3, verse 15, is that this prophecy is one of those instances, I believe, that God is meaning more than one thing by His prophecy. Just like in 2 Samuel chapter 7, He can refer to Solomon and Jesus in the exact same context amazingly. John chapter 8, verse 39. This is Jesus talking to the Jews, and they're talking about Jesus is trying to get their minds on the spiritual things, and they're just not really grasping a lot of things. And then some of the people who do believe, though, He kind of goes into further detail with them. In verse 39, Jesus says, "I speak what I have seen in the presence of the Father, and therefore you do what you have heard from your Father." And who do they quickly reference as their father in verse 39? Oh, Abraham. We know who our father is. We know that one. We got that. A father is Abraham. What does Jesus go on to say? "If you were Abraham's children," Jesus told them, "you would do what Abraham did. But now you are trying to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. Abraham did not do this. You're doing what your father does. You weren't born of sexual morality." We weren't born of sexual morality. They said, "We have one father, God." Jesus said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, because I came from God and I am here. For I didn't come on my own, but He sent me. Why don't you understand what I say? It's because you cannot listen to my word. You are of your father," who? The devil. Jesus is making all kinds of friends in verse 44. "You are of your father, the devil." You see, there is this line that was drawn back in Genesis 3:15. There is hostility between your seed and her seed. There is this line that is drawn in the sand, and we have to understand what is one side and what is the other side. Which side do I want to be on? The good and evil. Those, ultimately, the picture of the sand, the line that's drawn, is those who follow God and those who follow Satan. That is the line that has been drawn in the sand since the beginning of time. In the beginning, Genesis 3:15, this line has been in the sand. This is a battle that's going on for a very, very, very long time. One more picture of this battle, and look at Revelation chapter 12. I'll try not to jump around as much as I do this morning. But just trying to look at the bigger picture here from beginning to end. Now remember, Revelation chapter 12 is this picture. Remember, Revelation is a book of pictures, of imagery and things that we kind of see this unfolding, almost like a... I say, if you ever put Revelation into a movie, that would just be an awesome movie. This picture here, Revelation 12, is this image of the dragon standing before this woman who is about to give birth. And you remember, as the woman gives birth to the child, the dragon tries to grab the child, tries to take the child, but it can't get to the child. So it can't get to the child, it wants to do the next best thing, right? What does it go for? The woman. It can't get the woman, so notice in verse 17 who he turns to. Who does the dragon turn to? He's furious. Can't get the woman. So who does he turn to wage war on? The offspring. He's very clear in this text as who the offspring are. Who are the offspring that are talked about the dragon is waging war against? Ultimately, God's people. It's us. This battle is not just something that we sit on the sidelines and watch as Satan gets beat by Jesus. This is a battle that each and every one of us faces as Christians. So we are in this war. But what's more interesting about this war? What's so interesting about this war that's so different and unique from every other war that's ever been fought in battle in history? We already know the winner. Wouldn't that be amazing if you were watching a battle and you knew, well, they're going to win anyways. In fact, if you knew the winner, which side would you choose to be on? Yeah. Isn't that amazing? This is the only war that you know the outcome of the war. And yet, ironically, so many people choose not to be on the side of the winner. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that sad? We already know the outcome. We already know who wins in this battle. Revelation chapter 20, a few different pictures of this. Revelation 20, verse 10. Of who is going to win this. The devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Who's going to win in this picture? God. Colossians chapter 2, verse 15. I probably won't have you turn these to these, but Colossians chapter 2, verse 15 says, Jesus triumphed over the rulers and authorities. John 16, verse 33. Jesus says, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. You will have suffering in this world, but be courageous. I have conquered the world. This picture of victory is amazing because we already know that Jesus is going to win. So with that in mind, let's talk about choosing sides then. We know what side, what the two sides are. Those who follow God and those who don't follow God. We already know who's going to win. So let's look at this picture of choice. Turn to Joshua chapter 5. Joshua chapter 5. If you recall, Joshua, the book of Joshua is talking about the Israelites as they're going into the land of Canaan. They're entering the land of Canaan. They're going to conquer, and they start dividing up the land as to who's going to, you know, get what piece. Unfortunately, Dan gets a little portion. Manasseh gets two big ones, and I kind of felt a little unfair at that point, but that's how they divided it up. But they have this division of the land, this battle. But before all of this happens, the first place that they go, they cross over the Jordan, they left the plains of Moab, they've crossed over the Jordan River, and the first place that they have to go to conquer is what? Jericho. This big city, this big famous city on the side here is standing there as a defiant picture to the Israelites as they go into the land of Canaan. In defiance of the promises of God. No, we are the ones who own this land. We stay here. And so Joshua has a battle on his hands. The battle is coming as they cross over the Jordan. And Joshua has his orders from God. Go take Jericho. Notice in verse 13. Now it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite with him. Opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or are you for our adversaries? All right. Very clear-cut question, right? Are you going to stand aside and not going to mess with us or anything? No. Are you for us or are you for our enemy? Is there a little like gray area for here for Joshua? No. Why is it so important that Joshua identifies specifically where this man's alliances stand? Why is that important in a battle? Okay. For one, I want to win, and I'd like to know if this person's going to, I don't know, sabotage me, if he's on my side of the fence here. Why else would I want to know? You have to know who your enemy is. The difference of this, the answer this man gives to Joshua is going to determine whether Joshua is going to embrace this man as a friend or stab him as an enemy. It's a pretty clear-cut question. Are you going to be for us or against us? We're going into battle, and I need to know. So how does this sword-wielding warrior answer Joshua? He says what? Does anybody have the ESV version? What is the ESV version, his answer, the angel's answer? Okay, before that, though, what's his first response? The first word he says to Joshua's question? No. Okay. If Lindsay asked me to go, Alex, I really need you to go get me some milk. Could you go to the store and get some milk? Or would you rather go take Logan to this class? No. I don't particularly want to do either of them. That's basically, and I think the King James puts that in neither instead of saying directly. But the answer there is basically no. Just the shock to me at Joshua's question, he's asking him, I need you to tell me, you need to let me know, are you on this side of the line or this side of the line? And the angel completely redefines the line. blowing Joshua's mind apart. Hey, wait, what? What do you mean no? Neither one. See, the angel is pointing out to Joshua, there's a line that's been drawn in the sand far beyond this battle between you and Jericho. There's a line that's been drawn in the sand back in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, this hostility that has been there before this whole thing began. And I need to ask you, Joshua, which side are you on? Because I need to know. The angel says, no, rather I indeed now come as captain of the host of the Lord. I just love that answer. So which side are you going to choose, Joshua? And I think it's human nature sometimes to picture the universe revolving around us. We like to put ourselves as the center. My thoughts are the most important. My actions are most important. What I do makes a huge difference. And we have this tendency to think that our desires, our wants are so important. And subconsciously, I think sometimes we try to even fit God into our plans. The common question of many high school kids going off to college, which college should I go to? You know, which college does God want me to go to? In those situations, I have to remember that there is wisdom in choosing a place and where we go and surround ourselves with Christians and others who love God as well. There's a wisdom to that. But the question should never be, which college does God want me to go to? The question is, who does God want me to be wherever I'm at? Which side am I going to choose in every circumstance, in every situation of my life? Which side will I choose? Will I be for God or will I be against Him? And so we try to fit sometimes God into this little role. Sometimes redefining this line, what Joshua was having trouble with. We think about two sports teams. And I love watching some sports teams when they play against each other. Both of them are praying beforehand. Both of them praying for victory. This side's praying for victory and this side's praying for victory. Even if God were someone that we could manipulate to do our will, how could that even be possible? That both teams win? Maybe we pray for a tie, I guess? I don't know. During World War I, both sides thought that they were the right. They thought that God was on their side. We are praying that God gives us victory. The Civil War, both sides praying that God gives us victory. Both sides predominantly Christian in their mindsets. And that this happens throughout history where we try to feel like we're going to pit God on the side that we're on. And God is going to be on my side and which one I want Him to be on. All the while forgetting that it's us who needs to be on God's side versus Him being on our side. And this is the realization that Joshua comes to. When Joshua asks the person he encounters, you know, whose side are you on? He answers him, neither. Neither. The Lord's army isn't for you, Joshua. The Lord's army is to do the Lord's will, ultimately. The real question is not whether God is on our side, but whether we are on God's side. Are we submitting to Him? Do we really act like Jesus is Lord, or do we just try to fit God into what we already kind of wanted to do anyways? You see, we're conditioned, we're encouraged to ask ourselves, who is on my side? Who's like me in this situation where I stand? Who's going to be taking my side in this situation, in this fight? Who shares my views? Notice Joshua's response in verse 15. The commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." What is Joshua's response to this command of the host of the Lord's? Do it. Okay. Does Joshua's question even matter at this point to this angel? What matters to Joshua more than anything at this point is that he's doing what? He's doing God's will. And I think that's the way that we need to kind of shift our minds away from this. Well, are you Democratic? Are you Republican? Are you West Virginia or Virginia? Get away from the human divisions we put in our minds. Are you a Mountaineers fan or are you a Marshalls fan? God doesn't particularly care about that. Well, I think maybe some people here might. But the point is, we have these human divisions and we're asking whose side is God on, when ultimately we should always be asking and submitting ourselves like Joshua and realize, I just need to be on God's side. I need to submit my will to Him. I need to choose Him. There's a lot of opportunities for us to choose sides and join battles. And we need to be, with all our humility, with all of our worship, with all of our prayer, following God and His side. Not because, you know, God needs us on His side, but because we all need to be on His. And so that's what I just want to see from Joshua's perspective. With some of the remaining time, I'd like to talk about this challenge. There's some challenges to choosing one side over another. If you've ever been given a choice between one thing or another, there's a challenge of choosing and weighing the pros and the cons, isn't there? What are some of the challenges of choosing and totally committing yourself to one choice over the other? What are some of those kind of challenges in that situation? What's that? Okay, hoping I make the right choice. If I make the wrong choice, what's going to happen? There's consequences. There's things that are going to happen if I make this choice. And so sometimes, because of fear of the consequences, we just don't make a choice at all. And we try to, what, stay on the fence, don't we? I'm just going to ride the fence as long as possible. I don't want to make the choice. What are some of the other challenges of choosing and totally committing ourselves to one side over another? We can't compromise. What do you mean? Yes. There's a benefit to staying on the fence, isn't there? If I have a fight between two friends, and I have to choose which one of the sides I'm going to stay, take their side, why don't we want to take one side over the other? Okay, we don't want to lose him as a friend. If you take his side, then he's done. He's not a friend anymore. He knows he's a better friend than I am anyways. Sometimes, challenges of making a choice, we don't want to give up the option of being able to change when we see the outcome and the consequences. Why do you think people debate and sweat it over marrying so much? You're making a choice for the rest of your life, and you can't go back from that. This is the choice you've made. So I didn't take it lightly. I kind of sat there for a few months and was like, is this really the choice that I want to commit myself to and the consequences that go along with it? I'm glad I did. But my point is, we debate these kind of things. We want to stay on the fence for a longer time period because we don't want to take the consequences, or because we don't want to not have an option to be able to change sides. What I want to point out, though, in this particular battle is there is no staying on the fence. Again, this battle is very unique. There is no middle ground where you can hold out and hopefully wait for one side to kind of win over. We already know who's going to win, right? So there's no waiting. There's no period. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 15. You recall this is the church in Laodicea in verse 14 through verse 22. This picture of this church in Laodicea. And what was the struggle? What was the problem with the church in Laodicea? Okay, they were lukewarm. They wanted to be on the fence. They wanted to stay in that middle ground. This is interesting. When we look at this and say, "Well, I wish you were hot or cold. That way, you know, I knew where you were standing on this issue." We think, "Well, lukewarm isn't that bad." But look how he describes this. In verse 15, "I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish that you were cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I'm going to." And I'd like to hear, what are the different translations here? Spit. Okay, vomit. That's one of the more gruesome terms of this thing. "I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth. this picture of staying on the fence is abhorrent so much to God that he says, I want to just throw you up. It makes me so sick. Staying on the fence has never been an option in this battle. We have, by default, if we don't become committed and passionate about God, then we are on the other side. There's no middle ground. We say, I can share these passions, or I can be a little bit passionate about God sometimes, and then I'm kind of more passionate about my sports teams, and sometimes a little bit more passionate about these things. There is no middle ground for God. He says, you either love me and you keep my commandments, or you don't. Interestingly enough, the book of John, the whole book of John, does anybody know what group of people the book of John is written to? Is it Gentiles? Is it Jews? We say Matthew. Matthew's written to who? Jews, okay? Mark, written to Gentiles or Jews? Gentiles. Okay, who is John written to? Does anybody know? It's not as definitive, is it? It's a little bit more unclear. It's one of those challenges. I'm going to throw a word out to you guys, psychology term. My brother is studying to be a psychologist, and a term that really just made me look at reading the book of John in a completely different light. Liminality. Anybody ever heard the word liminality before? Okay, don't be ashamed. I had no idea what this word was before you mentioned this word. Liminality is described as the period in between. This gray area. The best example I can think of is they use it in terms of childhood to adulthood. When we ask the question, when does a child become a man? Is that an easy question to answer? No. The question has been debated for history's time. Why is that a hard question to answer? Okay, it's different for different people. Is there a definitive time period where we call somebody an adult? Okay, 18, yeah, but for our social construct of the expectations of an adult, are there certain expectations of an adult? Yes, there are certain things we expect of an adult. He should be able to hold a job. He should be able to support a family. He should be able to do these things. There's expectations of an adult. As a child, there is a definitive time period where a person is a child. My son Logan, who is 18 months old, is he a child or an adult? He's a child. We know that. Why? Because there's definitive things that we associate with what we call a child. He can't do a lot of things himself yet. He can't clothe himself, although it's hilarious to watch him try. There's a definitive period of time where he's a child, but there's also going to be a definitive period of time where he's an adult. But there's this period in between. That's why we call the teenage years awkward, because there's this undefined, sometimes they're both and they're neither at the same time as a child and adult. That's called liminality. What I would suggest to you in reading the book of John is look through the book of John with that lens. John is writing to what I'll call liminal believers, people who are in this in-between period of believing in Christ, fully believing in Christ, and those who still want to hold to the Judean world and the structure that's there. John, more than any other writer of the New Testament, emphasizes a very clear-cut line between one side and another. When you read the book of John, you'll notice you are either of the spirit or you are of the flesh. You are either of the light or you are either dark. You are either false or you are truth. John, more than any other writer in the whole New Testament, does this. He makes it very clear. There's no gray area for John in his writing. It's amazing. And I never looked at it until I started looking at it through this lens. That we're looking at it as John is writing to people, stop living in that middle ground and move to believe in Jesus Christ. Some of the examples in the book of John. Look how much time I have left. How much? Okay, so one example of the book of John. Look at Nicodemus real quick in chapter 3. John chapter 3, when Nicodemus comes to Jesus, notice, when does Nicodemus come to Jesus? Nighttime. Why is he coming at nighttime? Because of the Jews. He is afraid. When we get to the end where Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea are getting to Jesus, and they're going to bring his body. Notice in that particular situation with Nicodemus as well as there. But chapter 19, verse 38, like I said, I'm going to have to skip ahead, unfortunately. Chapter 19, verse 38. After this, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, because why? His fear of the Jews. Back when, in John chapter 6, when Nicodemus is standing up and he's speaking to the Jews, he's trying to defend Jesus in that situation in chapter 6. There's this situation where he's standing there before him and he goes, hey, you know, maybe this is the reason. And they turn to him and go, whoa, are you a Galilean too? What's his response? Nothing. Absolute silence. Nicodemus kind of, I really root for Nicodemus. I really want him to succeed. But John depicts him as somebody who is living in this middle ground. I want to continue to hold to my Judean culture, my history, the things that I have known my entire life. But I also know there's nothing, I can't deny this. I cannot deny that this is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I can't deny these evidences. But I'll just do this. I'll just stay in the middle ground. That way I can have best of both worlds. That's the way we think. I can have the best of both worlds. I can live the way I want to live, but I can also kind of follow Jesus whenever it fits my position. And what I want to point out and use the book of John as this example to further this point is that there is no middle ground for God. God writes in this book of John, what is the purpose of the book of John? He writes that at the end of the book of John in chapter 20. What is the purpose of writing the book of John? So that we might believe. He uses that term, believe, and it's not just I believe that Jesus and I know him. When he uses the word believe, he means that I may believe, fully commit myself to God. Just one of those examples I like to look, and I wish I had more time to look at other passages in that sense, but just in summary, the Gospel of John is really a lot about this idea of relocation. Moving, stop being in the darkness and move to the light. But it's interesting because the book of John doesn't talk about darkness a lot of times as this all the way over here. He's saying the darkness is this middle ground included in that. Anything that we put in that middle ground, the gray area, is darkness. Anything that's over here is darkness. Anything in the middle ground is darkness because it's not the light. And what we like to do is we like to try to rationalize and justify that middle ground a lot more than is helpful for us. Any thoughts about this so far? Any questions or comments that you have?
Mm-hmm. Not knowing that later they're going to have to join that battle. And I think sometimes people just kind of are watching and they're on vacation someplace, but at a later time I'll jump in.
Something that has occurred in many churches, and I don't know the congregation well enough here to know this, is this mentality of, I'm just part of the crowd. I'm just watching the service happen. I'm just kind of going through the motions. I'm just this observer. And Ephesians chapter 4 depicts us as each individual member doing its share. The minute that we start to imagine ourselves on the sideline of this battle, just watching and observing, the minute we start doing that, the minute we start moving in towards the direction of our enemy. Because all we're doing is just stepping back and letting these things happen. Was that famous quote, the only thing necessary for evil to happen is for good men to do nothing. And that's ultimately what we get into our mindset of. It's okay as long as I'm supporting somebody else to do it. But every individual member is doing its share. Every one of us is in this battle. And that's kind of just what I want to get out of this lesson here in choosing these sides. We already know what side is going to win. In the remainder of the time, focus on this. We already know what side is going to win. Many of us have already chosen God's side over Satan's side. When we've chosen a side, sometimes, though, we want to go back. Sometimes we have this desire to go back, to go to the opposite side, even though we know that side is going to lose. What I want to talk about the remainder of the time is why. Why do we choose to go back, to stand back on the sidelines, when we know we already know we're going to lose? Okay, it's easier. I don't have to fight. You know, it's always easier if I can let somebody else do the fighting for me. easier. It's more comfortable that way. Comfort is a big play in that, for sure. Why else do we choose to go back? Why else do we choose to leave the side that we know we're going to win? Okay, that was perfectly said. Satan would love for us to know and think that the grass is greener on the other side. Every single decision we make, it would be just so much easier, Alex, if you would just give up here. If you would just stop preaching. If you would just stop doing this. It would be so much easier. You know, it would be much easier if I went to work for Lockheed Martin with my top security clearance. It would have been much, much easier. But why would I not want to choose the easier path? Because I know where that's going to lead, ultimately, don't I? Right. Why else do we choose to go back, to go to the other side? Okay, because we don't want to let go of our friends. We don't want to let go of the connections that we have. That's a difficult choice, isn't it? I'm not going to sugarcoat that. That one's a hard choice. Letting go of some of the friends I had in my University of Memphis. Is that a five-minute warning, or is that end? Okay, James 1, we're drawn away by our own evil desires. Luke 12, the foolishness of not realizing that we are short-sighted. We're looking at life as a short time span, and we don't realize the immensity of eternity that awaits us. And Hosea 6:6, because, and Numbers 25, verse 1, because we replace the love of God with something else. We found a greater passion that we find more fulfillment in than God, and we replace that love. And so we end up going to the other side and choosing the other side. Thank you very much for your attention, and we'll begin services soon.